Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Vasilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 262, being recorded on the 18th of January, 2019, with special guest John Cazell. I'm Sajid, and on Teams with me, I have Cynthia and Kendall. And of course, our special guest, John, as well. And we're going to get to John in just a minute. But before that, let's get to some of the updates in the Azure space this week. Let's see, is there anything that you guys want to tackle, Cynthia and Kendall?
Yeah, I can start. So I want to talk about Azure Migrate being available in Asia and Europe. I actually haven't really heard or have used this service yet, so I digged it up a little. What Azure Migrate is essentially it's a service that assesses on-prem workloads. So when customers or people are thinking about migrating to Azure, they can actually run Azure Migrate first if they're thinking for something like a lift and shift. And with the assessment, you can start using services like Azure Site Recovery or Azure Database Migration Service to start kind of your initial phase going to the cloud. And now it's available in Asia and Europe. So people in those regions can definitely try it out.
Thank you. Kendall, anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, so there's several Power BI updates, but one that's pretty neat. So you can ask questions of your data within Power BI. It's a really neat feature, but essentially what they're allowing you to do now is that you can actually implement row-level security when you do that Q&A. So that means that a user might be asking questions of the data, and they're only going to be able to retrieve answers that are relevant to the data that they can be exposed to. So if you have a dashboard that has, you know, different views per what the user's permissions are, they'll actually just be able to get answers that are pertinent to the data they can actually see. So that's neat to have a lower level of security there to make sure that the data is protected per user. So I think that's pretty neat. And once again, if you haven't already seen the Q&A and Power BI embedded, I definitely recommend checking it out. It's a pretty neat feature.
Yeah, Power BI is one of those hidden gems, I think, with not enough people know about. So I'm glad you're mentioning it over here. And another hidden gem that I consider is Azure DevOps, right? I think we all take it for granted it's over there, but they're constantly making updates to it. And they have a whole host of updates that they've released recently. You know, the Azure boards, which are some of the either various Kanban boards or whatever boards that you may use for your particular style of Agile. So they've got, they try to simplify some of those boards. Now, so they've got some new simplification features, but most of the updates that they've announced are in the Azure pipelines, right? The build process. I mean, let's face it, that's the most common use case for using Azure DevOps is to build the build system. And, you know, they've added things like GitHub Enterprise Support, using authorization for the YAML tokens from GitHub. Let's see, I've got Grafana support, which is something that can help you, chart how the performance is going. You can query Azure Automation as part of your alert tasks now. So if you want to send out an alert as part of the build process, you could do it, run a query on that. They've got Docker CLI installer tasks, so you could kind of deploy a Docker container as part of your build task if you need to do a quick test, for example. So a whole host of updates is just too many to mention here, but it also goes on to some of the enhancements that they've made in the wiki space. So, along with Azure DevOps, you get a wiki along with every project. So they've made enhancements in some of the Markdown features and how you can edit the content in the wiki. So lots of new features out there.
Yeah, and Sajid, I just want to echo, I've been working in the DevOps space a little bit recently, and it really is incredible how powerful Azure DevOps can be, especially for work item tracking and all of that goodness. But yeah, I just have to emphasize what a neat product Azure DevOps really is and how it can super enable a CI/CD workflow that's really beneficial to your organization. So just wanted to highlight that as well.
So what, anything else you guys want to talk about? There was a couple of other items I saw here. Microsoft announces a partnership with Citrix. They're going to support the Windows Virtual Desktop now in Azure. So so that's a new update. And I guess you know, kind of a blog item or an update to the documentation that they have at Azure. But you know, compliance and data sovereignty, data residency, where data is allowed to live, you know, what kind of compliance you have in different countries, et cetera, that's always been a challenge. And so they've got a new resource out there. It's like a white paper that they've produced that kind of helps you achieve that, you know, compliance that you need to for your application. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But that's something that actually, we might even talk to John about today because it did touches upon some of the things that he's been working with. So having done all said all of that, let's move on to our special guest today. And John, thank you so much for joining us today. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners and tell us what you're passionate about in the Azure space. And for sure, tell us how long you've been with Microsoft.
Sure. My pleasure. And thanks for having me. I work for Microsoft Services. I've joined the company in 92, just a year, really a year after the birth of what was more known as MCS back then. So I've been, this will be my, I think by counting, 27th year at Microsoft this fall. I'm a developer at heart. That's my core competency, although I've had a lot of related positions over the years and certainly a lot of different specialties. I began as a Win32 developer. Got introduced to Exchange in the middle of the 90s, and then SharePoint at the turn of the century. And my latest craftsmanship is Cosmos DB, where I'm devoting all my effort at the moment.
That's amazing. So you joined you started off doing Windows DLL, so to speak, and now you're a Cosmos DB expert. So you've come a long way. That's all I can say.
Yeah, and if you look at it, if you step back, it's really about it's been really about the data. You know, Exchange was unstructured. SharePoint is unstructured. Cosmos DB is semi-structured. So it's just kind of applying the same principles of data to different levels of structure and access mediums and so forth. And a lot of the same. You know, compliance, retention, and access, and a lot of those rules still apply across the board.
So tell me, like, you know, when you had to make this move to Cosmos DB, you know, coming in from, let's say, as you know, an unstructured or maybe a fully structured model like SQL or something like that, what did you have to kind of mentally? How did you prepare to, or how did you make that move to Cosmos DB, which you know, which is a whole different kind of ball game.
Right. So with SharePoint, it was my last specialty, and I had done SharePoint for at least a dozen years. There was a lot of programmability to SharePoint, and I had made the conscious decision to kind of make a move back to the pure application development arena. And the Azure stack, so to speak, not the actual product Azure stack, but the Azure world, and begin to build those modern applications using the modern services. And the most logical avenue, of course, is to build, you know, platform as a service solutions or using platform as a service resources. And every application needs fundamental building blocks like configuration, logging, data store, you know, maybe caching, things like that. So SQL is like SQL Server, Oracle, those kinds of traditional relational database systems are really the database servers, the legacy database servers at this point. There's a lot of attention paid to the server and kind of the scaling of the server and the configuration of the server and so forth. And Cosmos DB is really the database of the future, and it's cloud-based, and I can certainly highlight a number of things about Cosmos DB, but in thinking about doing that development on Azure, Cosmos was really the only place to be as far as data storage in my mind, and I like to really master a particular technology and go deep on it more than I like going broad. So Cosmos DB was the logical place to go, given my background, given the database offerings.
And why would you say, like, you know, any company should pick, you know, Cosmos DB over, let's say, SQL or traditional database? Like, why, for example, why does, you know, your customer prefer to use that?
Well, because there's a couple of reasons. There's a lot of movement into the cloud in a number of fronts, and you can look at solutions and not only where their resources are located, but where they themselves operate. And I mean, you can certainly have an on-prem application accessing a cloud-based resource. You can have, to some extent, the opposite of having a cloud-based process accessing on-prem. But this notion of having on-prem, traditional on-prem iron is really a thing of the past. And as more customers, more companies migrate their applications into the cloud, you need some sort of database that's native to the cloud. So we're pulling in SQL Server to the cloud. We have SQL managed instance. We have SQL. We have SQL instances and things, but those are still manifestations of the same relational database model, which carries, you know, a whole legacy of really what amounts to be restrictions and overhead. So Cosmos DB allows that next generation of applications to be built, because the next generation of applications live in the cloud. They don't really care about where the database is, how much memory are in the servers, and, you know, how much IOPS the drives have, and so forth. They just care about running in the cloud, talking to services in the cloud, and they don't really need the sophistication and overhead of the traditional relational database. So that makes Cosmos to be perfect for certainly new applications, and to some extent migrating the data from some of the older applications.
That sounds awesome, John. So I had a question for customers thinking about going to the cloud. What are some of the disaster recovery part for Cosmos DB? Because I know a lot of people or a lot of customers wanting to go to the cloud, because then it provides a better sense of security when things do happen, because now they have their data in multiple locations. How does Cosmos DB handle that?
Yeah, the concept of disaster recovery are one of those traditional traditional architecture points that are changing with the modern applications, because there was different ways to deal with disaster recovery, and certainly there were overlapping concerns like backup and restore and availability. Those are kind of all interrelated with disaster recovery, and we even saw some companies have not have a specific disaster recovery plan, but rather have a redundancy plan, a business continuity plan, where they could just simply fail over somewhere else that was hot, and their application was constantly running, so they didn't really have to recover from a disaster because their system was hot in other regions. But that was back then; it was more expensive to do that. So, with Cosmos DB, it's a similar focus to that, where you can, depending on how you architect Cosmos DB, it can live simultaneously in other parts of the country or other parts of the world. So you can have the same data replicated around as widespread as you'd like, and be able to write to that data and have it automatically replicated around the world within a kind of a freshness or a speed of your choosing, And by doing that, it shifts the conversation from a pure disaster recovery to more of just a just having redundancy and availability. So when you're working with Cosmos DB, the focus is really on the global distribution of the data and the availability to kind of seamlessly route to those different regions for your data, more than it is if a system crashes, how do I recover the data? Because there's an incredible number of safeguards to prevent that, but just kind of getting back to the point of backup and recovery, they do take, the Cosmos service does take snapshots of the database by default every 4 hours and keeps the last two of them. So you do, there is a, and then those backups, by the way, are geo-replicated inside Azure, so they are very, very secure from a recoverability perspective. So if the service did suffer a catastrophic failure of any kind, the Azure team would be able to recover that data, put it back into service, and get it operational. If you have multiple regions active, that's less of a concern because you can just, there's the failover from one region to another can be configured to be automatic. So you just keep writing to that one endpoint that's region agnostic, and the service itself takes care of where that region needs to be hosted automatically to continue the business operation.
Thank you.
So John, I have a couple, actually have a lot of questions about Cosmos DB, just because I know this is such an emerging technology and that it can provide so many, you know, so well in so many different use cases. But one of my just initial questions, I'll take a step back to the beginning. How can I determine if Cosmos DB is the right solution? You know, how can I start to evaluate, do I need a traditional SQL database or a relational database, or could I potentially either migrate to or, you know, create a new application that's based on this technology? What are the first, you know, the first steps?
Right. So going in to sort of first look and first evaluation of Cosmos, the kind of instinctive reaction is to say, hey, I'm going to keep my traditional database as the default database unless I find a use for Cosmos DB. And part of the challenge is retraining that mindset into, okay, I'm just going to use Cosmos DB unless I find a reason why it doesn't work, because more often than not in the modern workloads today, it's going to, the database will actually apply to most workloads. And if it, one of the challenges or one of the realities we have with a relational database is there's a lot of features, constraints and structure and so forth that aren't actually used, and developers and system designers and things either don't use them or find them constraining in some respects. So a lot of that functionality and sophistication goes unused in a lot of systems today, partly because the systems are becoming more and more segmented and granular with, for example, microservices or something where one service does a lot less, but it does it really well and really fast. And there's no, and it can't be constrained by a lot of relationships with a lot of back-end data and so forth. It has to be very focused and very unconstrained in how to manage its one little piece of data. So those, so only in those cases where you would have some sort of big monolithic system that had a lot of was kind of like an online transaction processing system with a lot of interdependencies and a lot of side effects and a lot of relational requirements and referential integrity and so forth. That would have to be the workload where Cosmos might be difficult to get into. But as the cloud systems become more granular, more specialized, and so forth, and a lot of that intelligence, the business intelligence is built into the microservices and the application layers, the database itself doesn't need to have that sophistication.
That totally makes sense. And following on that, what if we're in a situation where maybe I'm not going to have a ton of data. So, you know, obviously data gets generated. Most organizations, most applications are going to generate a good bit of data. But I know one thing about Cosmos DB is it can just support so much massive amounts of data. So is there still, a tier or use case in scenarios where we don't need massively scalable, global, distributed access to the database? Could that still be a good use case if it might have less, I guess, extensibility or need for that massive scaling?
Right, and that's one of the beauties of Cosmos is that it'll scale big and small. We like talking about the massive scale of Cosmos DB, and you know, we really like to say it's unlimited size. It's elastic. It's it has guaranteed throughput, so that no matter how big the database gets, your transactions always complete in a predictable amount of time at a predictable cost, and you pre-provision that throughput. But at the end of the day, you can also create like the smallest of database that's only a few dollars a month of cost and write one row or one document to that database if you'd like, or write a few documents. One of the popular use cases in kind of that lower spectrum is actually a cache, really an alternative to using a Redis cache. And developers like the idea that they can write, you know, a handful or a dozen values or something to Cosmos, have the speeds almost approaching Redis speeds, because there's guaranteed service level agreements down to, you know, anywhere down to almost single digits for reads, and, you know, under 15 milliseconds for writes. So it makes a great alternative to cache, and it has the added benefit of actually being distributed, redundant now between regions. So you have now a writable, readable, and synchronized cache for, you know, what we were talking about earlier of data continuation, business continuation. So you can write as little as a few documents that's only, you know, a gigabyte in size or less, or you can have a monster data set that's upwards of petabytes of information in Cosmos.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that if you're starting a greenfield application today, there's no reason why you shouldn't consider something like a Cosmos DB first, right? Unless you find yourself in a place that has a large number of dependencies, as John is saying. And even then, I think you get, you know, it's a matter of building the application to work with a NoSQL database like Cosmos DB. But you have to start with that first, I believe.
Yeah, some of the challenging, just to add on what I said before, a couple of the challenging use cases are I mentioned the complex entity relationships. That's certainly, those would have to be, instead of kind of being enforced by the system, those would have to be enforced by the application. There is, you know, if you have complex queries or ad hoc queries, there's one of the things about properly designing a Cosmos database is it's advantageous for you to think about those queries up front. So you it's a different mindset, whereas with something like SQL, you would build your system and then run it to see how it performs and then scale the hardware up if you needed to. This with Cosmos, it's kind of the reverse, where you really want to pull that prediction up front by first understanding the size of your items, the number and type of each operation you're going to do on a database, the CRUD operations and queries, and you want to kind of know that up front so you can predict the size, so you can provision the size properly ahead of time. So doing that kind of world makes it a little bit more difficult to kind of put some sort of ad hoc reporting system on top of it that does unpredictable queries, which are very expensive. There is systems like Apache Spark and things and Azure Search that let you that kind of build a front end on Cosmos and let you do some of those ad hoc things. But if your application is going to plan on natively doing that, that's not the thing that Cosmos DB likes the most. And one last thing, there's actually presently a 2 megabyte size limit on documents that are stored in Cosmos. So That's not a showstopper. You might have to store your documents outside of Cosmos with maybe just a link in your data, in your Cosmos document, but you do have to be conscious of document size for your applications.
Awesome. That's really good. So, John, let's kind of move on to when a company, some kind of a medium or large enterprise, wants to adopt Cosmos DB. Obviously, it's a new thing for them. Yes, they've gotten over the application requirements, but let's face it, if they were using SQL and Oracle in the past or whatever other database, they used all the kind of safeguards, the compliance, all the other things that those database systems brought to the table. How do they achieve similar things with Cosmos DB? Like, what are some of the things that, typical traditional things that large companies look for that they can get out of Cosmos DB?
So there's kind of a two-edged sword here. It's on one hand, it's easy to get started with Cosmos DB with the unrestricted nature of it and the low friction of entry. But on the other hand, flexible and low friction, and developers can get started easily. So it's going to be one of those things where a company would traditionally have DBAs that help you build your schema. You'd have people that were concerned about deploying the schema to the servers and preparing the servers for use, and certainly the design of the data access and so on by the developer community. So all those functions still have a place with Cosmos, but they just get simpler. And I think it helps the company to still have those concerns and those services in place. So it's good to have them in place, but I think they just kind of have to retool to some aspects you can think of as the NoSQL, right, the no schema mentality, and some of it is retooling from an operational perspective from servers to services. So I think if systematically taking each of those areas, the architecture, the design, the DBAs, the monitoring people, the support people, the developers, and recognizing each one as having their own retooling needs for Cosmos, I think that helps kind of repurpose the same people in the same roles for the new database world. So I think that's having the reverse happening of having a developer kind of just go off on his own, find Cosmos DB on the web, fire it up on their MSDN subscription, or their Cosmos has a local emulator as well for development, and just start writing code and then say, this is great, I want to ship this, and then no one around him knows how to deploy that or maintain it, is a little risky, and eventually they're going to have to deal with that. But I think, again, to summarize, I think just the same roles apply. I think it's just up to the organization to see how those kind of same concerns apply to Cosmos.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, obviously the customer requirements are still going to be the same. It's going to be applied to a different database system, and then Cosmos DB, needs to adhere to those requirements. But for when it comes to like compliance or making sure that systems or companies are in compliance when they use Cosmos DB, are there any things that you can think of that Cosmos DB can be used, can be kind of configured or tweaked a little bit to make it a little more compliant, let's say for PCI or other kinds of compliance?
Yeah, I think there's a couple layers to that when we think about compliance or words like that. I think there's there's actual certification of the system itself, of the Cosmos service itself, and there's a whole battery of certifications on the service, from ISO certifications, PCI, HIPAA certifications that just really proclaim that the service meets these certain benchmarks for security, data sovereignty, for privacy, and so forth. So that's level one on the service side for compliance. But then inside your corporation, even if you don't care about any of those certifications, you have certain controls in your enterprise that need to be cared for. And those are really two major areas there. One is your corporate policies. So that's really what you're holding yourselves to, as far as how you want to secure your data, where you want your data located, how you want it used. But those are the policies you impose on yourself. And then there's policies that the government imposes on the enterprise. And those are things like SOX compliance controls, where they require you to say, okay, you need to demonstrate that you can recover your system. You need to demonstrate that only a known number of people have access to the data, or only those known people can set the backup and retention schedules. And those governmental controls, those SOX controls, are a little problematic, because the service doesn't give you unfettered access to your data stores. You can have as much access through your Cosmos data, but if they do backups every 4 hours, you actually can't just send an email and say, I want those backups here, deposit them in the storage account. They're not, those backups, the images and the back-end data to the systems are extremely controlled by regulations and privacy acts and things, that you can't just walk in and get your data, even though you own it. So it makes kind of responding to some of those SOX compliance controls a little bit more difficult, where you might have to keep shadow copies of your own data, you know, using like the change feed to replicate out your data. You can ask the Azure service team to set custom backup schedules, and you can test restores of those schedules anytime you want. And the product group is very flexible for large customers. Well, they'll set, you know, they can set backup schedules, you know, to 2 hours or maybe even 1 hour in special cases, and keep more than just two copies. So the product group has been known to work with, with the large customers for custom ways of handling the backups and schedules and things. And certainly the support ticket request system is getting more and more mature to allow only those people that have, you know, so let's say Cosmos operator privileges and so forth, to have authority to change schedule, request restores and things.
And you know, cost is always a big thing, right? With customers keeping an eye on costs, although these are pay-as-you-go costs. How do customers, you know, large customers, deal with managing the cost of CosmosDB? Because, I mean, obviously, if not kept checked, these things can run away very quickly.
Yeah, and the cost is similar to that of any traditional database or other service, any kind of service. You'll have not only your production costs, but you'll have your load testing environment. You might have a user acceptance testing environment, integration, development. So you have all these different environments that are likely to have different instances of Cosmos. And for obvious reasons, you want to keep the cost of these lower environments as inexpensive as possible. Because you're going to have more of them, the production systems, but at the same time they can kind of be a little sloppy in how they're provisioned, because it's not as critical if they're over-provisioned or under-provisioned, the cost will be low and the risk will be low. But in the production systems is where you want to have that cost tuned as accurately as possible. The idea that you're going to have your most data there and or in load testing. And there's certainly a lot of ways to predict what that cost is going to be, but the overall principle is you want to keep that provisioned side, the provision throughput, the request unit, as low as possible while still giving your application normal function. So it's certainly easy to over-provision the back end, but over-provisioning it and right-provisioning it is going to allow your application to run at the same speed and quality. It's not going to affect the quality if it's over-provisioned or right-provisioned, but it will affect it if it's under-provisioned because you'll get a number of retry requests on your application if it's provisioned too low. So it would be normal to get a few percentage points of retries on a correctly provisioned system. You never want to size your system to have absolutely no retries, and that's an indication really that you're over provisioned.
Cool, very good. Well, this has been really great, John. Thank you for all the experience that you've shared on Cosmos DB. I know you've worked extensively. We worked together on the same customer. I know you focus a lot on Cosmos DB, and this is really valuable feedback you're giving us. And Cynthia and Kendall, is there any other things you can think of we should ask John before we let him go?
One of my questions is just where do you typically send people if you say, okay, you're interested in potentially embarking on this journey? Obviously, we have some Microsoft docs, but really, what's step one? Is it just assessing the application? Is it going to Microsoft Learn? What would you recommend, John?
There's one of the refreshing things about Cosmos is the abundance of documentation, abundance of samples, of APIs, of community support and activity. So there's almost a you could almost say there's too much too much support out there and too much information out there. But would I if I were getting started, I would head over to there's a quick start section of the Cosmos DB documentation, and that's segmented into kind of the data models like SQL and MongoDB and Gremlin and things. And then within each of those sections, there's your favorite API, your API models, your interfaces for things like Java and .NET and Node.js and things. So pick your desired workload, pick your API, and then just go in there, and it helps you provision an instance. It has sample code to get you started, and you can be doing a hello world application inside of an hour. And then what I would like to, I kind of tend to start with the hello world and build out from there. And I think that's learning things when they're needed, I think, is most effective. So start with that quick start and start with the hello world.
That's excellent. Thank you, John. Really appreciate, again, you coming on and spending more time than we expected. I mean, I know we're sorry for keeping you on for such a long time on this call, but thank you for sharing all your experiences there. And we'll take, if you have any links, like some of the ones you just mentioned, any, resources that you think our listeners might benefit from, please send them to me and we'll add them to the show notes when we publish the podcast.
Wonderful. Will do. Thanks for having me.
All right. It was a
pleasure. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.